This is a production of Cornell University.
UA meeting, February 27th, 2008.
Begin right now with the NCAA presentation. So, and this is half an hour, maybe less, what I understand.
Cool. We'll keep it fast.
Oh, well, as you wish, but half an hour was what you were allowed. Yeah. So, the first item on the agenda actually says 40 minutes here. That's interesting. Presentation about NCAA recertification process will be made by, yes, go ahead, and I get this one.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having us. I'm John Solicano. I'm the Vice Provost. This is Mary Opperman, who's the Vice President for Human Resources. The two of us are co-chairing the NCAA reaccreditation process. The NCAA, National Collegiate Athletic Association, have to accredit Cornell in order for us to play intercollegiate sports with our competitors. They last, or initial accreditation was about 10 years ago. This is the reaccreditation process. Their basic goal is to make sure that the way we handle college sports, and in particular college athletes, is consistent, and that we avoid the kind of scandals that you repeatedly hear about at some other institutions. And so we're chairing that process. The reason that we want to meet with you is that we want to report out to a broad group of constituencies in terms of what the process is finding. The nature of the process, the core element, is a very extensive self-study by a committee that Mary and I chair that is made up of several subcommittees, and that in turn is made up of several other subcommittees. The NCAA is very detailed about what they need us to produce. The ultimate document is a very extensive self-study in which we evaluate our own sense of how much we are in compliance with the rules, requirements, and expectations of the NCAA. Then we do, as we're doing now, reporting out in quite summary form to different groups on campus, including the University Assembly and a variety of other faculty groups, student assembly groups, what we are finding as a way of soliciting any feedback or answering any questions. The self-study itself is very long and detailed, repetitive and bureaucratic as well. That's posted on the Cornell website after the EDU /NCAA will bring you there. There are three areas that the NCAA asks us to study in particular. They have somewhat odd names. We'll talk a little bit more about what they are. The first is called Governance and Commitment to Rules Compliance. That is being chaired by Nelson Roth down at the end of the table, who's the Deputy University Counsel. Again, we'll say what these are in a minute. The second is called Academic Integrity. It's chaired by Rosemary Avery, who is the chair of the Department of Policy Analysis and Management in Human Ecology. And the third is called Equity and Student Athlete Wellbeing. That's chaired by Professor Dale Grossman in Applied Economics and Management in College of Agriculture. Dale is there next to Nelson. Sorry, Dale. We began the process in 2007. The subcommittees have been working ever since to prepare a draft. We now have that draft and are now seeking to report out to you all and seek any input. The revised draft is due back at the NCAA in early May. They visit next November. It's a team visit in which they spend several days here examining it. And then they'll issue a decision to reaccredit us. That's what we hope will happen, and we don't see any issues in terms of that. Mary will talk about the next subject.
So we thought what we would do is tell you in summary form what the self-study groups have found. Before I do that, Steve Erber from the Athletics Department is here as well, and Kristen Walker, who's staffing the project, is here. And so when we have questions, one or more of us will try to answer them. So as John said, there are three subcommittees that have been meeting for many months now. The first one is the Governance and Commitment to Rules Compliance. area. Again, that was chaired by Nelson Ross. There are two areas for review under NCAA. The first is institutional control, presidential authority, and shared responsibilities. And the operating principle is responsibility for the conduct of the intercollegiate athletics program, including action of staff members and representatives of the athletics program. And the second area is rules compliance, which assures that staff, student athletes, and other individuals and groups representing intercollegiate athletics interests comply with applicable NCAA rules and regulations. The key findings of this subcommittee, the subcommittee found Cornell to be in substantial compliance with all requirements. There were areas of concern. One area of concern was that the athletics department compliance manual needed to be updated. That's now complete. And that there needed to be a more more timely scheduling of a required compliance review, which was also completed in December. The subcommittee found that under rules compliance, Cornell was in substantial compliance with all requirements. One area of concern was that some booster club bylaws lacked specific reference to compliance requirements. That has now been corrected in the bylaws of the one booster club that was corrected last month.
The second broad area is academic, what the NCAA calls academic integrity. The basic goal here is to make sure that our student athletes are treated as students and athletes rather than treated as athletes who are here to be nominally students. Obviously, what they're concerned about is the kind of recruiting scandals and poor education, high dropout rates that occur in other universities that are extraordinarily committed to their teams winning. This doesn't tend to be, you know what I mean, the Big Ten kind of schools where you have these repeated scandals. And so the NCAA sensibly wants to check and make sure that we're actually doing right by our students and as athletes. So it falls into two groups in the NCAA view. One is the question of academic standards, and that's to make sure that the educational component is an integral part of the student-athlete experience. Our findings, which are consistent with last time and not surprising, is that Cornell is in compliance with all NCAA requirements in this aspect. It focuses on a variety of things, including recruitment and admissions. Our recruited students, student-athletes, are held to the admission standards set by colleges and are subject to the same admissions procedures. There's no special backdoor for student-athletes. The student-athletes are required to maintain good academic standing, and good academic standing for student-athletes is the same as good academic standing for students who are not athletes. The requirements at Cornell, not surprising, are much more stringent than what is common in the NCAA. This is reflected in graduation rates, which is something that NCAA looked at. Our student athletes graduate at a very slightly lower rate of 88% than our non-athletes, which is 92%, a quite insignificant difference. Our male athletes graduate at a slightly lower rate than our female athletes, but that exactly mirrors what's occurring in the general student population. In terms of race, the cohort is really too small to make those kinds of analyses, but we know of no particular issues there. In terms of academic support, which is providing student athletes who have obviously a big commitment to athletics with the kind of support they need on the academic side, we're again in or way above compliance with what the NCAA would expect. The findings of the committee are that Cornell maintains a proper balance between the athletic and academic expectations and opportunities of students. There are good, adequate support systems available for students. Academic advising systems for students are robust and properly assigned to the colleges.
The third subcommittee, which was actually a subcommittee that had subcommittees, is equity and student-athlete well-being. The areas that this subcommittee was required to look at were gender issues, minority issues, and student-athlete well-being. In the area of gender issues, the key findings were that the subcommittee found that Cornell was in substantial compliance with all NCAA requirements. There were areas of concerns noted, particularly in the need for improvement in some of our facilities. The competition and practice facilities for all students was deemed adequate, but there were some locker rooms, training or meeting spaces that the subcommittee felt needed improvement, and some of those included the spaces for women's crew, women's lacrosse, softball, and volleyball. And the women's boathouse renovation, which had been anticipated in the 1999 review, has not yet been completed. In the area of compensation, it was determined that the compensation practices for both the coaches of men's and women's sports, was based on market equity and therefore equitable. The proportion of women athletes has grown actually beyond the goal that was set in 1999, now to 46%, to bring the participation rate closer to the proportion of women in the student body, and the subcommittee notes that Cornell must plan for the growth in women's athletic opportunities to keep pace with the anticipated increase in the proportion of women students overall. In the area of minority issues, the key finding again, the subcommittee found Cornell in substantial compliance with the NCAA requirements. An area of concern, diversity among student athletes appears to lag behind the proportion of minority students overall. Particular issues were raised among Asian American and Black student athlete cohorts. However, student athletes identifying themselves as other in the race and ethnicity column has grown from 12% to 25% in the last 3 years. The subcommittee recommends continued partnership with admissions on minority student recruitment. In the area of minority issues, staff diversity in athletics has improved and reflects both the university and nationwide trends. 10% of mid-management staff identify themselves as minority. 2 head coaches are identified as minority head coaches. 10% of assistant coaches identify themselves as minorities. The subcommittee found diversity recruitment practices in athletics fully sufficient. Finally, in the area of student-athlete well-being, the key findings were that the subcommittee found the university to be in substantial compliance with all NCAA requirements. The student academic support services are well integrated with university programs. All student-athletes have access to these services. Student athletes are made aware of the university services in the area of career counseling, personal health and safety, including alcohol and drug prevention programs. Athletic training and sports medicine services are equitably provided to all student athletes according to the NCAA guidelines and meet all NCAA standards. Student athletes have the opportunity to provide feedback about their athletic experience through end-of-the-year evaluations and senior exit surveys and interviews. Athletics has an appropriate grievance and appeal process in place for student athletes. Student athlete rights and responsibilities are well defined in the handbook, and student athletes have opportunities to participate in athletics governance through student athlete advisory council. So in sum, and not surprising, the university was found in substantial compliance with all NCAA regulations. But the subcommittees decided to go farther than just the NCAA and did give the university additional suggestions for improvement. As John noted, the NCAA guidelines are really set up to very stringently review practices in universities where scholarships are given to athletes, where there has been practices by booster clubs and others that basically make the athlete an athlete first and a student second. We don't have those issues. We checked hard to make sure they hadn't crept in. They had not. So the next steps are that we will report to the Board of Trustees in March. There will be another open forum shortly after that. We will revise the report as needed and submit it to the NCAA in May, and then, as John said, they will be visiting in the fall. We look forward to our decision sometime after that from the NCAA. They can certify us. They can certify us with requirements for improvement, or they can fail to certify us. Those are the three areas of possibility. We're here to take any questions you might have.
Thanks very much. Questions?
Right. I have a suggestion. I had been teaching just upper level courses, and then 15 years or so I had one football player. But this year, the past couple of years, I've been teaching a 100 level course with several hundred people, a lot of them. And I was at employees' day a few weeks ago, and saw a hockey game and a basketball game on the same day. And it dawned on me that that although I've been looking at my students just as students, I knew that they were athletes. I realized they have another full time job, and that they're doing a great service for the university, bringing a lot of joy to people. And I just, at that same time, I just happen to have some student athletes that are going, that not only would miss the prelims, but the makeup and all that. And I was happy that I just reached that awareness,
mm-hmm.
that I could say, okay, I'll give you a special makeup.
Mm-hmm.
And because they really wanted to do the work, they weren't trying to get out of any work, but they just needed a little flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of wish, I don't know how many people over the past couple of years I didn't give flexibility to, or I didn't present myself as flexible, or something, maybe nobody. But if there was some way that you could have made me aware a couple of years ago about what everybody, what the student athletes say is coming to Cornell, and that we're allowed to have some flexibility,
mm-hmm.
or perhaps just think about it.
That's an excellent suggestion. I think that's an excellent suggestion. I think we start by assuming that everyone knows the time commitments of the sports, and most of us, unless, don't. The other thing that's true is that we have quite a body of student athletes who maintain 4-0s. There's a 4-0 club that, a celebration for all student athletes who can keep their grade point average at a 4-0 each semester. So they are truly students first and athletes second. When they ask for that flexibility, it is important, I think, for us to do a better job of helping faculty understand why they need that. I think that's a great suggestion.
Dan, any others? Dan.
I don't know if I heard you correctly. You said that approximately 10% of your coaching staff identifies themselves as agricultural
minority.
But that's pretty small compared to the total number of people in the population who would identify themselves in this category. So how is that in compliance? You said that was in compliance. How could it be in compliance?
Well, of course, there's no quotas, so the effort for review is on the efforts made to diversify the coaching staff. And I can tell you, it's about the that is about the composition of the employee population here at Cornell. We struggle, and I'll say we are going to continue to struggle with every coaching recruitment. The better our teams are, the harder it is for us to hold on to every coach, every assistant coach, because we are not a Big Ten. We don't pay the salaries. We really struggle to get coaches who will move here, and especially at the assistant level, they're still building their careers, and so we try our best. As a matter of fact, Cornell was the only university in the country to receive an A from the Black Coaches Association a couple of years back for our recruitment efforts in our football search, and we hired a white man. But we were the only university in the country that got an A because of our outreach and attempts. It's difficult for us to get coaches here. It's difficult for us to diversify. We really struggle. So that's the standard, is your efforts. You're required to make sure that your efforts are, your outreach is good, your connections are good, that you're pipelining as you're supposed to be.
Jane.
Well, when they say ethnic minority, I know it's self-selected, but what all does that include?
So in the area of our employee population, it's all identified ethnic minorities. Black, Hispanic, I'm not going to get them all, but includes Asian American, Native American, Pacific Islander.
Any other comments?
And also increasingly there's multiracial as well as biracial.
May I ask, is there any action that you require of this assembly, or is it a matter of just presenting us the findings?
Well, right now we're presenting the findings. Then what we're doing is the steering committee is now reviewing the draft. Once the reviews are done, it will go up on the website, the NCAA, www.cornell.edu/NCAA. And if anyone is interested, it's about 150 pages. So I understand if nobody takes me up on it, but it will be there for any drafting comments that you would want to make. Otherwise, the next time we might be asking any of you to participate would be when the external review team comes next November, this coming November, to talk to them and answer any questions that they might have.
Okay. Tomorrow, will you be interested?
I'm not sure how relevant the report, but I'm curious, is there any evaluation that looks at the number of any discrimination cases or issues that are brought up to council among athletes that have to do with discrimination based on sexual orientation?
It wasn't a required review in the NCAA. So what we were required to look at through NCAA. So the short answer is I don't know that we keep the data on discrimination complaints and on the basis of the discrimination complaint by student athlete, by identified as student athlete. What we were required to look at by the NCAA was an assurance that they had the same access to the complaint procedures as everyone else. So I'd have to see whether the complaint processes have a way to capture that information. Since it's reported, all of the complaint information is reported out anonymously, I'd have to check to see whether the people that take it in ask whether the individual is a student athlete. I don't know. Okay, that's an excellent suggestion. I wonder if the other way to get at it is around proactive training programs and conversations around the issue rather than waiting for the complaints to come through, because it's also very difficult to file complaints sometimes in those cohort groups.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
that's fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Thank
we look
you.
Forward to any future needs you have for our consideration.
Thank you.
So, now, the agenda is different, as you can tell, than what's on the page. And so I think we can go back to late editions, but under roll call, I wanted to say, please, everybody, make sure your name is signed in, because that's our that's how we tell that we have a quorum here, which we do. Are there late additions to the agenda? Dave had asked me if he could perhaps have a sufficient amount of time to talk about the link between health services and the UA, and so what's registered here is 5 minutes. Will probably not be five; it might be 10 or more. Are there any other requests for late additions? Yeah. An open forum. Well, let's see.
3 minutes.
Why don't we? Can we just get through a few? And yes, I'll write that down. It's open forum. No, for sure. Is that agreeable to everybody?
Sure.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Bill Liddick is not able to be here. He has a death in the family, so we won't be having a report on family services. But there has been discussion. There is a written document about that. I don't know that that's been circulated. But it should be if it's not, and I'll find a way to do that. Tomorrow, would you be willing to hold forth on tomorrow on academic integrity? You have a report here which we can refer to. No, that was going to be after we have the reports.
Okay.
I thought. Is that? Did I give you a miss?
I was just making sure that I had the agenda. Okay.
No, the problem with the agenda is that it was changed after it was published, so we have to we've just readjusted things.
Okay. No problem. Thank you. So this is a report of a meeting that was held on February 4th with Dean Walcott. The summary of the issues that we discussed and the points of why we held the meeting are summarized in this report, follow-up note, future events that have taken place since this report was written. 2 points of interest. One, just this past Monday, February 25th, the GPSA passed a resolution on academic integrity. It's not circulated here. It should be in the minutes if you want to see it. They're basically saying this is the position of the GPSA on feeling a strong position on upholding academic integrity within the GPSA itself, and then each member that is part of the assembly go back to their respective institutions and help promote academic integrity and the principles of academic integrity. A second follow-up note is that Dean Walcott's office has scheduled a follow-up meeting for the subcommittee on March 10th. So to anybody who wishes to attend here, and if there's anybody that you know of who would like to come and participate, please invite them as well. I'm not going to go specifically into what one of these things, because the detail that's in this report is very specific to the discussion that we had in that meeting. So if there are any questions, I'll open up for questions now.
Seeing none, moving along, I guess. Thank you very much. Oh, sorry.
What do you mean by that?
One of the ideas that was brought up in the brainstorming was for special contact for the
school. So it's actually having in the application, you know, essay one, why you make a permanent essay two, what's actually concerning.
Just to get a feel of those sort of coming point, what would they think that actually is quite accurate?
For Denise's benefit, would you say what the question was? I think think that's.
She was in the point on the report brought to me for an intern. Specifically says, considering adding an application essay or short application essay on integrity as a supplement to receiving from someone of academic integrity in a packet, say, from the university when it responds.
Could you speak? Speak.
I didn't mean to be a counter, but I don't see how you wouldn't get 10,000 for the
perhaps the students who are writing, if an essay should end up on the application packet from Cornell for students, if 10,000 students write the same essential message that academic integrity is important, then that we should have a code of academic integrity, and that a student does uphold academic integrity in their current practices and intend to continue to uphold academic integrity, that's great. Because then we have an entire body of students that applied to this university saying they understood what academic integrity was. Then we would imagine prevalence of academic integrity decreased. If that's not the case, people are spitting out things that are not true, in which case we would continue to have to find ways to evaluate the status of academic integrity at Cornell. So again, this is just one brainstorming idea that showed up at the table in a set of first discussions. How do we address
that? I wanted to say one experience that I had. Last 2 years ago, a student brought in notes for the same thing and another student's I went to the code book because I had never looked before for academic integrity. And I talked to somebody that in my department that had experienced academic integrity evaluation. And he told me he was a person and then wait a week. And then during that week, the violator has a chance to think about all the horrible things that they have. And in this case, the violator came back and said, yeah, that's what he did. And then I said, okay, I'm going to give you an app. But there's a chance to rebuild over the semester. And I was happy that you got a second chance. That it wasn't for us in the house. Put a word in for Marcy.
Okay, just an update on that. I think Cornell does have a suggested course of action when there are infringements on academic integrity recognized in class among peers. Unfortunately, not everybody knows what that course of action is. It's pretty standard and it's pretty similar to what you just explained that you did. It's sort of common sense.
Oh, no,
imagine you confront a student and you give a student an opportunity. And if they did do it, then there's a discussion about what do we do next. And it's only in those cases where there's a disagreement between student and professor about what do we do now, where there's an option to bring in a mediator from the office, I guess the State Hall's office of where then you can have assisted in finding a desired course of action among the parties.
Okay. We are going to have continual discussions of this as your committee goes forward, and I think it'd be quite useful to have a periodic report. Jules has a question.
I just had a quick question. What was the likelihood that action will be taken on this soon rather than later? Like last year, there was a very similar discussion that went on in the UA. There was the idea of an application essay that came up, but then nothing happened, and now we're doing more discussions that came up with the same answer again this year. Is it going to be acted upon, or is it going to kind of keep going on like this?
From what I understand, Dean Walcott is very dedicated to actually doing something about this starting this semester.
Great.
My understanding is that our second meeting is going to continue the discussion about brainstorming ideas, including the topics that have been brought up and brainstormed in discussions that happened after the first meeting that took place. So since this meeting, Dean Walcott came to the GPSA and had a meeting with us specifically, I believe,
yes.
He came here and discussed the issue here with us and got some more ideas. So there is now a long list of ideas from
a larger pool of faculty and a larger pool of students that is going to be incorporated into our next meeting to start talking about what are we actually going to do now.
Great.
So the brainstorming is done. We're going to start moving into making a plan, and I think before the end of the semester we'll start to see a very specific plan.
Great.
Thanks very much. So, Mark.
Yep. Yeah. We had a meeting, the first ever meeting, or at least even several years, the Cornell Store Advisory Board. That's Chris and myself, and the Deputy Director and Strategic Projects Manager of the Cornell Store. We discussed a lot of the various issues that they came to us a few months ago with. One of them that I really wanted to focus on, bring back to the assembly, and kind of think about, like, I guess, an idea how we can confront it. In all the textbook crisis, and what we came down to was that the Cornell Store's ability to get used textbooks is largely dependent on national wholesalers, and their ability to do so is very much a function of when they find out or how early they find out what textbooks they need to purchase. I think the dates are for spring they were looking at sometime early November, and for the fall semester sometime in, you know, April 10th-ish, finding out would be kind of optimal for their ability to buy used textbooks. And I was kind of brainstorming ideas of my own about how we could kind of educate faculty in a very positive light in terms of the benefits to students of getting their book list early when possible. Because I just think it's a function of faculty don't know necessarily always kind of the entire review. So I kind of wanted to open it up and kind of get suggestions how we could maybe confront that.
Right. From experience in my position in the University Registrar's Office, I can say it's all well and good to do that. However, at least half of the faculty don't know what they're going to be teaching. And that's the underlying problem. And we're coming across this as we're working on the project, that they can't... Either they're not able to, or they aren't inclined to choose what they're going to be teaching for the next academic year.
And how does that, I guess, process work? And I guess there's nothing about it
by department. Or?
In the art college, we do have to turn our courses in instead of in support, so we have a pretty good idea. I think the main problem for us, speaking to the faculty that we struggle to meet those deadlines, is that you're in the middle of the semester and you're just overwhelmed with teaching and administrative work. And to create a course, even if you've taught it before, you want it to be up to date. You want to be the best things that are out. And that takes so much reflection time and search time and reading books and articles. It's just so hard to do that in the middle of the semester.
Well,
is there any way you need to get the sort of work with you to make that process easier?
There's still the discussion of one thing they've also concerned that I don't think it's common to affect the effort to order exam copies. But as far as I know, that's also what we have in the past. So we need to ask the father to get one of the purchases to do that yourself.
These meetings with them are going to be ongoing. I'm going to try to sit them with them and kind of start reflecting this from there into what they can do.
Thank you.
Well, thanks. Thanks for getting that dimension of our responsibilities going. All right. So, Dave. Dave. No, I'm sorry. I guess I'm up first. I'd like to keep this discussion brief about the campus code, only as a quick report that we are the process of considering President Gorton's requests for reconsideration is in the hands of the Codes and Judicial Committee, our Codes and Judicial Committee. There have been two meetings. Full meetings of the Codes and Judicial Committee, both with participation from the full committee, including members of the administration suggested by President Gorton, who are both members of the committee ad hoc and others who the president requested would participate. At those meetings, the first meeting, I think it's been reported accurately that all but three of the issues that the president asked us to reconsider, asked the Code Judicial Committee to reconsider, were settled upon to the satisfaction of the representative of the president there and committee, Code Judicial Committee members. The president's counsel, his university counsel, James Mingle, has been delegated the responsibility of representing the president's wishes and interests in the deliberations. And he was at the first meeting where those agreements, one could say, were reached. And as I said, it's very important to emphasize in saying that these are agreements that the Coast Judicial Committee found, that they initiated in many instances and approved of in all circumstances. And the three areas that are still being discussed are right to counsel. I'm just being short about these. You can read more about them. The president's interest in having the right to overrule the decisions made by the hearing boards in cases of violence or threats of violence or a third category, serious disruption of the educational environment. And the third one is, it's on blank on me. Can anybody remind me of the third? Very important one. Changing the level of proof from clear and convincing to preponderance of evidence. And all three of these were left to subsequent meetings because it was realized that the 10 elements in which we agreed on proper courses of action would be easy, but these are the hardest. There is some movement in getting the issue about presidential actions to reconsider or to reconsider verdicts by the hearing board. There's some movement in making progress on that, and the others about attorney and proof will be discussed at the next meeting, the CJC, where the council, the university council, and others of the administration will be present to confab about. So I think the timetable we have is meeting of the CJC on Monday from 4:30 to 6:30. Those are open meetings in the sense that any of you can attend. And Congressman Wayne was there for the last one. And then there'll be another meeting of the CJC next Monday. And we expect that with those two meetings, there will be a CJC document that will result, that will come forward and come to the UA. And we've asked the UA that document come by the 15th, even though we don't meet until the 27th. Spring break intervening there. And our hope is that it's coming to us early enough that we can reflect upon it and discuss it amongst ourselves, perhaps not in a meeting, and by email communications, and get some way that we can not have the same wheel spinning at our meeting that we could have, in terms of debate, that we could have resolved a lot of issues of debate so we can have a good, clear, and well-grounded discussion on the 27th at our meeting and pass a
a letter or a resolution, whatever form it would take. And it, yeah, Dave.
Who was voting? Do the ad hoc members on the committee have a vote?
Well, right now, I think you could safely say that it's preceded by consensus. That is, at the first meeting, there was Councilor Mingle was there, Mary Opperman was there, Tony Bruce was there for a period of time. Dean Walcott was there. I should mention one important thing. Before last Monday's meeting, President Scorton asked members of the Assembly and others to meet with him, the leadership of the Assembly, and had very open, frank conversation about issues. And if you want to report on it, I think Jules might be able to report on it, but if you don't. So it hasn't been an issue where there's been enforcement of a particular point of view. It's been very much an interchange, an exchange with the CJC. And there's not been any voting necessary in the sense that there's been consensus reached.
On the easy issues.
On the easy issues.
But now what's going to happen when you get to the hard ones?
My impression from the way things are proceeding is that the CJC will take its point of view and advance it, and there won't be, in other words, if it doesn't come to a consensus, then there may well have to be a vote, but the vote would be only of the CJC members because it's their committee.
Are the ad hoc members?
They're not voting members.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us about the possible solution?
You know, I was thinking I wouldn't, only because it's just something that's been, well, I mean, I'll give you a hypothetical then, because it's not something that's a proposal formally, and I haven't seen the language that is being drafted. But the solution to the question of presidential review of hearing board decisions about violence or threats of violence or issues having to do with serious disruption of the educational environment, a possible solution to that might be to have a clause in the code which says that the president has the right to, and then this, the question is whether the word would be recommend or require, and that's why I don't want to get any further, because a reconsideration of a hearing board verdict by the hearing board, and that reconsideration would be initiated by the JA. So, in other words, the president has the right or respond or to request or require the JA appeal, one could say, a verdict which he feels isn't sufficient, or he or she, whoever the president is, feels it's not sufficient to address the problem of violence or threats of violence or disruption to the educational environment.
Sorry, I wasn't here for the last meeting. I guess I didn't understand it. Now, you're not talking about appealing, but defendants appealing to the president. You're talking about the prosecutors appealing and actually having acquittals on the president.
No, not acquittals. These would be only in cases where this is why it's difficult to get into. The hearing board makes a finding. The finding is of guilt. The hearing board assesses a penalty for violence or threats of violence or serious disruption. The president feels the penalty is not sufficient for the offense or addresses enough the needs of the victim, recognition of the victim, and has the right to request the judicial administrator to ask the hearing board or to reconsider the verdict.
So
the penalty.
So if they define the person not guilty, so none of this happens. So he can't say, okay, look, he's really guilty, you guys are wrong, we're going to punish him.
No, it's not a question of questioning the finding. The finding is already in.
It's just the penalty part.
It's the penalty part.
Thanks. I didn't get that one.
Yeah. I mean, that's what the president's request was. Yeah.
not to reconsider the case, but to find, yes.
Have you had a definition of what serious disruption of the educational environment?
We're working on that, and one of the things that was brought up at the last meeting was the need to separate, perhaps, violence and threats of violence from serious disruption of the educational environment because of a lack of clarity over what constitutes serious definition. And members of the gathering at the meeting asked, you know, is this specifically designed to quell a campus protest? And the university council said in no way is it that. That a serious protest is not meant at all to be designed in that regard. However, it is clear that has the potential to be that, and we're not living in a fixed system where it's always going to be the same people playing the same information. So the point that I want to raise here is that the possible solution to this is the penalty, if we're talking only about the penalty phase, not the prosecution phase, in other words, and if we're talking about to just completely leave out the phrases violence or threats of violence or serious disruption, just completely leave them out and put the clause in that any verdict that the president feels in any case is any assessment of penalty that he feels is not sufficient to address the needs of the victims should be permissible that the president would appeal to the JA to revisit. So that leaves out the whole ambiguity about defining what a serious disruption is. And I don't think it really concedes it doesn't create a situation where the president can intervene. One thing I wanted to bring up in this regard, and I don't want to go any further, much longer, we have a couple of important things more, but the campus code, this was made clear to me, it came clearer to me at the last meeting. The trustees do not control student behavior on campus. They don't have the, they do pass upon codes that come to them, but they do not have as a part of their charter that they are responsible for all the behavior of the students on campus, as far as I know. The president does have that authority. The president delegates that authority to the university assembly. It's not like there's a separation of powers in the clear sense of we are the executors and we vote bills and they go to the president for a signature. I just want to, this is something that, and that difference means that the president has a degree of responsibility that has to be in some way the structure of the code has to recognize in some way, and so one wants to think about how to do that in ways that don't create situations where the president can where there's not sufficient diffusion of power into the community and community governance. Yes. And I think this clause might be able to handle it, but that situation where the president has the right to ask in the case of penalties which are not severe enough.
And it's just a question of appeal. It's not that he can override.
What happens next is not clear, but I think it is not. I don't see that it would be an override. I don't see how that's possible because it's a question of revisiting, the hearing board's revisiting, not the president saying that that I don't agree with the hearing board twice and this is what I'm going to do. That's my take on it. But this hasn't been ironed out, and that's why bringing it up is raised for a longer period. Actually, I want to get some responses, other responses, if there are any. I don't want to. Is this all clear to you, or is it an issue for you? Okay, then Dan.
Just quick ones. One was, I was wondering what his views were on coordinating this with civil authorities. In other words, we're talking about bioreacts.
Yes.
These people are across the street downtown.
Right.
So if they're acquitted downtown,
mm-hmm.
does that end at Cornell? In other words, see what I mean.
Well, I see what you mean, but I don't think. I don't think. First of all.
No.
What?
No, they have two separate processes.
They're two separate processes.
So one is not dependent on the other.
Quitted or downtown, but the Cornell would go after them separately and say,
maybe not.
We don't think the civil authorities are right.
Maybe not go after
well,
them, but the two
separate is the judicial system, and it's the judicial administrator, it's the hearing and review board.
Right.
And the hearing and review boards are a separate process. And I don't think we can build into the code, or at least not in this iteration of it, if UA members want to propose it, as possible, that if you are acquitted in a civil process, you cannot be prosecuted in the school. I don't think we can do that. Not with any code can we do that. That's on the boards. That's on the books now, or it being considered now.
Well, he seemed to object even to the very mild suggestion that the JA would consider postponing until the civil authorities have.
That's been resolved. That question. Mm-hmm. That's been resolved. Or at least the proposal has been. The CJC feels it's resolved, and it'll come to you folks at your meeting on the 27th.
The other question I had, we didn't oppose this because I wasn't here, because you probably already covered this. And it kind of goes to the function of the UA itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, you said that this isn't my Congress, and certainly I understand that. But it wasn't the president that gave us authority, it was the trustees. And even though the president has authority to ask us to reconsider it and veto it, we don't. I don't think that the central administration has the authority to preempt legislative action. In other words, to say, look, I'm just going to do what I want anyway and not bring it to you. And that's just the judicial matters, but all of these other matters that we've been talking about.
Yeah, well, I don't
because
think,
that's where the,
I think
that's
we've
where
gotten past that. I'm hopeful that this process has shown we've gotten past that
problem. That's where things go down.
Right.
Marty, yes.
Was that they preempted the legislative activities in the UA.
Jules or I can probably address that issue because that was in the meeting that we had with him.
So who would you like to address
it? I'm just going to let you.
Somebody has to decide.
I think we have an interest in making sure that the administration, if they need to be what we do, fine, but they don't preempt legislative action. In other words, they just don't go ahead and do stuff that's under our purview. They have to wait until they want to veto it. And that's an important distinction.
About 2 weeks ago, like Marty said, a couple of us met with President Thornton as well as the CJC. And basically what I understood from that meeting was that it's a work in progress. So he wants to accept the document as a whole, not accept certain things and disagree with others. And basically his perspective was he was coming at the document with, X amount of years in higher education and coming at each individual part of it from things that, looking at how other schools do it, and a lot of the things that he disagreed with or said needed more work were because no other school or very few other schools actually did it in the terms that we proposed or that was already written. So that's where a lot of his ideas came from. And I know a lot of people felt like it was a complete turnaround, but he is really trying to keep this, a dynamic process and, keep conversation flowing because it's never going to be a finished document. There's always going to be improvements that can be made to it. But we want to make sure that right now we turn in the best possible one that everyone kind of agrees on. Was that what you said?
Yep. And he's outright said that his intent was that he was going to accept certain parts and then throw other parts out. He wants to be able to send it to the trustees in its entirety. Even if it takes us two or three times to look at it, to rework it, he's willing to put that effort in.
So I think as our letter said, this is following the procedure that our letter laid out, and it's in keeping with everything one you would hope, I think, would be the right way to do things. Any other?
Marty said that the language silence or the press silence may be taken out, so that's just an overriding.
No, it would still pertain to. Yes, go ahead.
And so, one of the fears is should that anything mean civil disobedience or protest. And when somebody brought up an example, if somebody created a virus that just made in place to shut off, the president might
That's why the language was trying to be extended a little bit.
Yeah, and I asked if there could be people bringing examples of threats to the educational, serious threats to the educational environment. That one was brought up. Several others will be brought up. But once again, keep this in mind that this is not the president saying, we're not doing anything about this, I'm going to step in and this is my verdict. This is that this violation will be processed. If somebody disrupted the entire campus computer system with a virus, or even a significant part, that would be a violation of the campus code. And that person would be prosecuted under the campus code. And that would go through the campus code. If the verdict wasn't sufficient, the president would have the right to return the verdict, a return for reconsideration. That's what this is talking about. And that, okay. Any other? Yeah.
Marty, do you know where the location is of the Monday meeting?
No, I don't, actually. Do you know, Peggy?
163?
No, I think we're in the Cornell Police Conference
Room. Yeah, Cornell Police Conference Room is what I thought.
We can send something out to confirm that, right?
Please.
We are there, and we'll send out a reminder.
Thank you.
4:30 on Monday.
4:30 Monday, the Campus Police Conference Room.
Is that behind the secure door?
I'm sorry, what?
Is that behind the secure door?
Well, yes, but it's punched open, okay. So you can get it. David and hi, and David. Well, we have 20 minutes left, so David, would you let David go first, or would you prefer to go first? It's not about your grant proposal. Okay, yeah, David, please.
Like the Cornell School Advisory Board, part of the UA charter includes Board on University Health Services. And just like the Cornell School Advisory Board, it hasn't really been too much lately. And I wanted to create that link with UHS. And from doing that, we have sharing today. And you know, we didn't decide what that link is going to look like. And I don't know if Cornell is going to be for a minute or two about that.
Hello, everybody. There's who chimed in with me here. I work at Gannett Health Services as part of our leadership team and have participated in various interconnections with all of the assemblies over quite a few years, including with this body directly and through an organization called the Board on University Health Services, which has been home for a period of time. Something like 10, 15 years. So we aren't really sure of the origins of it, but I was around at the time that it was decided by members of the UA to take a pause and see if we could create a different way to maintain a strong tie between the representative bodies of the university community and Gannett Health Services. Like perhaps some of the other liaison groups that reported to UA, this was one that just wasn't functioning well. We had about 8 members of our staff who prepared for and attended monthly meetings with members of the Board on University Health, and we employed a lot of efforts to get people to come and have meeting material at the meeting. We have something in the range of 6 to 10 people there, and a different group of people all the time. Our colleagues in the Office of the Assemblies worked very, very hard to identify a membership for the Board on the University of Arts and had a hard time doing that. We had direct liaisons from the UA. That was really a much better system because we had that direct connection. A couple of new folks who were meeting on a regular basis with members of our leadership team to stay in touch about the issues that were of concern to your constituents. We anticipate we're concerned to people who rely on us for services, and that might be opportunities for us together to think about where we're going in the future for providing individual health services and counseling, as well as attending to some of the university-wide health issues.
So we come on an annual basis directly to this body, our director and several other people from the leadership team, discuss issues, have an open dialogue. And it's just that in the last couple of years that we haven't done that. I'd like to suggest that we not jump into recreating something that wasn't really working, but maybe have a group of us from Grinnell Health Services and the UA try to sit down together and think about in our current context what we think could be a really vital connection between our groups and perhaps facilitate more vital connection with the other assembly. We do have some meeting points already in place. There is representation from various assemblies on the President's Council on Alcohol and Other Drugs, on the Council on Mental Health and Welfare, on the Student Insurance Advisory Committee. These are all committees that were initiated, but are university-wide organizations. We participate in things such as the Graduate Student Initiative, the Asian American Task Force, different organizations that come from other origins, but that draw people together to think about student life, employee concerns, related broadly to the issue of health. So, and I'd like to have an opportunity to think with people before jumping too quickly into something that was created perhaps in a different time with a different sense of how people communicate with each other, and make sure that we create something that's not going to be just an exercise, but a meaningful way for us to work together.
Well, we have a committee that we're, as you mentioned, that we are responsible for calling, I guess. And when we first started this semester, Ari's suggestion was we should either be responsible, have representatives to those committees, or and participate in the meetings and then report back, or we should find some way of doing away with the committee. At the same time, we had a new committee, the Family Services Committee, which was initiated in order to take over something similar to what you're describing, or analogous to, in the area of human services, that just started to be on the books. It also has many different fingers in different areas. The one that's quite active now is having to do with the Children's Center. And it will have other areas in which it will be active too. So what comes to mind is something analogous to family services, or at least us creating a representative to come to a meeting or a complex different people from different subcommittees that you have coming together to see what kind of a relationship should be developed, or how the committee that we have already on the book should be reconfigured to reflect this changing reality. And I suppose since Dave brought it up, maybe he'd be willing to be our representative to go through that process of deciding what we should be doing, what kind of committee we should be. Pardon me? I'm notorious for speaking on people without them volunteering, but yes. Transportation has gotten going.
So, in the period of soul searching where the UA basically invited all of the groups to come and talk to us and said, you know, is this actually effective? And there were some, you know, livers of it contained people in the air, and this is a problem. And that was when we decided to try a traditional structure to change the operation of the UA and undertake a sort of ad hoc charter change and see how that would operate for the year. One of the things we decided to do was to still have a representative who attended all of those meetings, and he
information sustainability ad hoc group that we could support to try to address that. So I was just asking, keep in mind there was some history of it, sort of relationship, and it's probably good to be talking to people who were there at the time who made this decision. But we were definitely adamant that we should continue the relationship, but not be working with the board in the sense of in the past, it was like really the overseer and have to approve everything that those organizations did, and that was the sort of purpose of that community engagement group. If we wanted to change that relationship at the time and make it one more of a sort of liaison and formative role.
Well, your last sentence rose a little bit of when you say the UA is supposed to approve. We've gone through it with regard to transportation. Question of what the UA is supposed to do in respect to these committees. And as far as I'm aware, I don't think that, although we have oversight over some policies, we don't have the day-to-day nuts and bolts approval responsibilities or even power. So I don't think that's what we'd have in mind. But I think it is important to have... without saying we are advisors and all we are is another way of gathering information from the campus, without going that far into impotence, it'd be useful to at least retain some role that we have in vigorous participation, and that the reports are nothing, are more than just, this is what we're doing, here it is, isn't it nice, goodbye. So perhaps if we have some kind of discussion about this, just like we are with transportation and with planning to a certain extent, we've started at least some conversation of that sort, and with codes and judicial, which was the impetus for us rethinking our power relationships to these different areas of campus. Maybe then we'll have a report about that, and we can think a little bit more about how it pertains to the health services. Yeah.
Did you follow the
CJC
Board of Action for discussing the campus fund and getting input from the community and crafting?
Yes.
So I think that was great. Absolutely great. And a model for how everything else can work. So if that had some issues, like insurance that would interest everybody, or mental health that perhaps could interest a lot of people, or you want people to get interested, this body may be the right body to bring one of those issues to bear to everybody, and then come to some kind of conclusion that's valuable to everything.
For the TGSC, how did you get members to connect with?
Well, the TJC has only one UA member, and it's at me right now, the representative, and I'm not a voting member. We convene it, and I'm the channel of communication. The CJC itself consists of a representative body from around the campus, just as some of your committees are that way. The Family and Services Committee is the same way. The Planning Committee is the same way, and the Transportation Advisory Committee is the same way. How you get the dynamic to get people involved is, unfortunately, it's the role of the committee. In the cases of the dynamics of the committee, you have to get together and say, this is an important committee, let's get some people, representative group to air issues in front of. And you follow what I'm getting at? Is, in other words, you can't say to the UA, all right, you started this committee, now you got to staff it, now you have to make sure everybody participates. It's not the way it works. It's not the way it worked with the CJC either. The CJC has its own kind of dynamic of organization. And that's true of the Family Services Committee. What happened there was that there was already existing a group of people, a representative of a wide range of the campus, who are participating in these deliberations about family services. And it was sort of ad hoc out of the Human Resources Department. And the Human Resources Department said, something wrong with this. This isn't as widely representative or diffuse, and it has the appearance of being entirely central administration control, where it should be more representative of campus needs. So it came to the CJC with a hope for it. Now, that it could be, and the committee was set up with those people already participating and additional people coming on board. I think we're going to go, yes.
May I just say that we haven't had any trouble drawing people into conversations around these focused areas, the mental health, the alcohol and other drugs, student insurance. The challenge that we had, I think, to work on university health was people who were interested in mental health related issues weren't so interested in occupational medicine issues. People interested in public health and response after 9/11 or anticipating what we're going to do in a pandemic flu aren't necessarily the same people who are interested in student insurance and what does the plan cover. So it was too broad a mission to pull together a group of people that had its own momentum for getting together. And I think that's one of the things that we're all challenged with. The UA, Gannett Health Services, is how do we pull people together who want to meet because they share common interests and then build on that energy. And I think one of the things that you can trust from Gannett Health Services and from the university is we want the input of the community around issues that are of concern to the community. So these groups that have grown up over the last decade or so come because the community is saying to us, we care about these issues, we're saying we care about these issues, let's bring a group of people together so we can focus on it. And it does have a bit of that ad hoc feel to it. I don't think we created the Council on Mental Health and Welfare with the idea that it will live in perpetuity. It came together because there's a need now, and it has lots of momentum going. It's going to be around for quite a while, but it may not be here forever. And I think that's the direction we want to go, is to try to identify ways that we can come together out of our shared mission and make conversations happen that people want to have happen, and not waste people's time by our coming in and doing a roadshow. Here's what we do.
I think it makes sense at least for David to come and have conversations and perhaps come up with a couple of other people either in this body who could join you or other interested people who to join in the conversation and then bring a report back to us to talk about the issue of what you see as the right configuration for this in relation to the UA. Jules.
To echo that, I think probably the best way to get re-involved with this would be to pick a topic you're really passionate about that's already meeting and maybe start going to those meetings and start figuring out how, like, you know, either the university assembly or yourself can get very involved in one of them and then slowly branch out in that direction. I know from student leader meetings that one of the big issues for graduate students and undergraduate students is mental health, so I'm sure a lot of students are very involved with those discussions. So maybe it might be a good idea to start going to, like, those meetings or something else that you're more passionate about and, like, start thinking about how the UA maybe could get involved with some of these issues and try to make things happen. I know the SA just got involved with mental health, and they have a new program that started in the fall, I think it was.
Yeah.
And so, you know, maybe doing something like that and bringing on the bigger, like, to, like, so that all aspects of the community can, like, benefit from it.
Well, maybe as early as at the end of our discussion of the codes, question on the 27th, we're going to whip right through that, I'm sure. We can have a bit of a conversation about this in between now and then. You can do some spade work to see how it could work out. Thanks very, very much for your
Thank you,
Dave,
for
getting
the conversation back on the table.
Great. Janet.
My turn?
Yeah.
So I have a business problem that I've encountered the last 4 years in my undergraduate student academy. So I decided to come to the UA with this because it seems like it's being a uniquely situated body to help me out with this. So as some of you know, I've played with the Cornell Jazz program for the last 4 years here. I've been a really active member of the U Jazz Ensemble. And that requires being in a combo of students that are put together every semester by audition. And this contains students from all over the campus. The majority of which are from engineering and from the sciences. It's a really great way to meet students from all over the campus community. We've had a rising problem for the last 4 years that's really culminated in the end of the semester, and that is prelims and scheduling of prelims.
rehearse together outside of those 20 classes. And the thing to note is that actually the Jasmine couples are actually a credit class. So that means we've changed our scheduling of our class. And recall that we're all from different parts of campus, some of undergrads, some of those are undergrads, all of us in different fields and programs. So getting us together every single time is a different place is really difficult. And I kind of feel like this is getting out of hand, and I feel like this should be opening some kind of discussion at the university level about scheduling of curriculum. Because I think there's four ways in which this is really disrespectful. On the one hand, it's disrespectful to other classes because these are French courses and they're audition only, and it's assumed that they're sort of extracurricular, maybe because they aren't in the person's main subject of study, but there is actually a concentration in music now, and a lot of students are actually using these classes and ensembles. They're required to play in ensembles in order to get credit towards their degree. So, and I'm assuming also that sports and athletics and other off-campus groups are actually, or on-campus groups, have the same problem. I've heard this from a number of other students in the Jazz program. It's also disrespectful to other students in the ensemble or the group. It kind of seems like the professor assumes the only person that they're affecting with their prelim schedule are the students in class and maybe the grad students to proctor. But the effects are felt throughout the community. Every time someone has a prelim, I'm not even in engineering, and I've rescheduled my entire life around engineering prelims for undergraduates for the last 4 years. So I imagine that this is actually similar for other organizations, and it's not just me and the graduate students, other grad students, other undergrad students, and the faculty who actually supervise the course. I also feel like this assumes that students are considered changeable, and that the individual character of the student isn't essential to the flourishing of that organization. So when people say, oh, well, you have a prelim, the thing is we'll get substitutes. Just get someone else in who can, you know, play on the team, or, the saxophones are kind of a dog who doesn't want your saxophone to come in. But from the experience of being with these groups, is to actually build that team over time and have that extraordinary experience of playing with these people. And my combo this semester is compositional only, so we don't actually have scores, we're writing it, and that relies on the participation of very specific musicians in that group. So we can't just, you know, say someone else like each other because there isn't any music, and that chemistry has to happen with the experience that happens. So it kind of feels like just assume that activity is something that you can just interchange students for. It's really disrespectful to students, kind of your way of mental approach. And I also feel like this privileges one kind of learning over another. And this is perhaps the most important thing in the humanities. But it kind of feels like the university says, okay, music, that's not really a real subject. Or at least it's not as important as math and engineering. And in the humanities and fine arts, or at least those of us who choose to supplement our studies, for the sake of our academic pursuits, but also for the sake of our mental health, with other kinds of what's considered extracurricular activities, fine arts, for pursuits for credit, we're asked to sort of move over every time, for especially the science and engineering careers. And I feel like if Cornell is serious about educating the whole student and fostering an environment for interdisciplinary exchange and for mental health, then participation in these groups should be respected as an essential part of the experience. And this should be, you know, given equal standing, or at least some kind of respect alongside the main focus of your academic work. And I should mention this also has to do with collaborative learning. I mean, most of the stuff that I've learned as a member of these ensembles has been from working together as a team, not sort of, which is contrasted really strongly to like the individual who has to study and write things down for this assignment. So there is also a value not just in humanities and sciences, but also to the collaborative work. So I feel like this is really coming at me. I'm sick of this, I'm fed up of this, and I want to know what the university's policy is, if anything, on scheduling prelims, and how our interest body can address it. I've attended four institutions of higher learning. All of them are world-class, and this is the only one in which required exams and courses are scheduled outside of class time throughout the semester. And everywhere else I've been, like University of Cambridge, UBC, University of Copenhagen, this would be considered incredibly disrespectful and out of order. And I'm not arguing that students' work shouldn't be evaluated. I mean, yeah, sure, examine them if you need to examine them, but examine them on your own time, or at least in some kind of dedicated classroom, or dedicated maybe exam time. At UBC, we would have a midterm week that basically happened either before or after the spring break or fall break, which were considered study breaks. So there would be an opportunity to focus on that activity. And I understand that it was thought perhaps at one time that staggering prelims would be beneficial for students to have time to study,
impact of that is going to be felt throughout the community as all of these different student organizations have to move over for freedom to basically everything. So I feel like this has been a detriment for the community as a whole, and I'm just wondering if there's anything this body can help me with in order to figure out where this policy came from and where we can possibly go with it.
Susan, you said you would like to speak to this.
I can try to at least provide some of the facts, you know, that everybody understands. I might not be able to bring this up, but it is faculty legislation. There actually was a faculty committee of the faculty center maybe 2 or 3 years ago that was very Avery. Mm-hmm. Actually, before that, Susan Moliero and Rosemary Avery chaired looking at this plus a variety of issues around child crime and child crime. So you might want to talk to Dean Walcott and get a copy of that report because he's probably the most important thing to do. But in general, policy is being defined by the faculty is Tuesdays and Thursday evenings for prelim nights. And that is set aside, as a defined prelim, and there's a group of folks who come together to schedule the prelims and try to minimize the overlap. Monday and Wednesday are class nights. And then the 4:30 to 7:30 time period is when there are to be no scheduled classes other than those that are approved by the dean of the faculty or by the dean of the college in class that exists to be offered, so that things like that are non-curricular, but here you're talking about a curricular conference and have credit, but so that the co-curricular opportunities that happen for students, be they meetings like this or whatever else.
All the musical ensembles are exempted from that curricular restriction so that they can take place between 4:30 and 7:30. And that's sacred time. I mean, we debate this in the music department a lot and discuss it, and people do complain about it periodically. And I think you're right, there have been agreements Tuesday, Thursday, but you may be talking about times when the agreements are breached and there isn't anything to patrol them. And it may be useful for us to have some testimony of that sort and bring to people's attention. Maybe that would be maybe a good activity on our part to have take some action.
It seems like it puts together the schedules on an ad hoc basis based on when students actually have time to. And it seems like maybe because the Tuesday and Thursday nights are blocked off from those kinds of activities to be sacred for freedom, then those seem to be the only times when students are actually doing those things. So that would be why
they do them maybe in class on Monday and Wednesday.
Exactly. And already the guys are fumbled like a larger benefit.
But I can tell you, we've had this issue brought to us many times in the music department. So, I want if someone is willing to have some statistics, put some statistics together, there shouldn't be prelim scheduled during the 4:30 to 7:30 time period. Even review sessions should not be scheduled. So there's like sacred times every day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. If there's problems with that, I mean, maybe the UA can take some action to try and redress it.
Is that the period that you're concerned with, or is
no,
it later?
No, it's
There is another point that you brought up, which of course would extend this, and it would have to extend the meeting to talk about it much more, but it could be something that we could take more formal action on, and that would be, should there be prelims outside of class time? And that would be a big one.
And I think that was when those were some of the questions that Susan Caliero's committee and hopefully also the agency committee, they did a major survey of students and gathered some information and that discussion, and I understand it was in the faculty center.
Yes, it was. But I don't know how major the gathering of information from students was. It'd be useful to find that out. And if you're willing to take that on, is there anybody who would want to work with Janet on this?
I will.
All right, Jules.
Good.
I
have
a
school student on Humboldt Middle School, and I'm wondering if there are any ways that we can help them with that.
No, I understand.
we really can't go too
much. I have qualms too, so I'll work with you.
Man.
Just a real quick point on this. These sort of demonization and these sort of things fell completely out of practice in other institutions like that, because unlike Cornell, which has very different undergraduate culture, a substantial number of the undergraduates in California were had families, children, and to also throw their term, as you call them, at them ad hoc during the term when they hadn't planned for it in their schedule was just devastating for family life and everything else. So after a brief experiment with it, people, it wasn't much gracious, it's just they had you know, Cornell up until recently has had a different culture than we had with one of our undergraduates. Some of our undergraduates have families. Most of them don't. It's not like that. Well, I think with veterans coming back from the wars and all this sort of thing, we're going to be maybe shifting to more older and better students, and that pressure may be added to yours. There are great alternatives to fusing.
Well, I want to
have a smaller footprint. I don't need it, but some people like it.
Speaking of timing, we really do have a responsibility to everybody, to certain folks, to leave. But Rodney, quick things.
Also take into consideration that the evening prelims are, I think one of the reasons they were also created was because of room space and to house large lectures and exam times. And mind you, that space is not getting more plentiful at this point.
Well, let's look further into it. Thank you very much, Janet. Thanks very much. Thanks to everybody. We'll see you on the 27th, if not before. Oh, move to adjourn. Everybody in favor?
Aye.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.